on this week's program, Eric Brannan profiles William T. Trigo. The Michener Museum in Doylestown is hosting the first ever retrospective of the little-remembered Pennsylvania Victorian-era painter. We speak with the Austrian pianist Rudolf Buchbinder. Susan Lewis considers the beginnings, evolution, and contemporary mission of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And we speak with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, authors of the children's book Art Museum Opposites. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Pennsylvania has been the birthplace of many iconic artists, like the 19th century realist Thomas Aikens, the 20th century furniture maker and sculptor Wharton Esherick, and the late Andrew Wyeth. However, mention William T. Trigo and you'll likely be met with blank stares, though he has since been forgotten by many. The Bucks County native was once internationally lauded for his paintings of military conflicts. Now WRTI's Eric Brannan takes us to the Michener Museum in Doylestown for So Bravely and So Well, the first ever retrospective of the artist's work.
William Trigo was born in 1858, just 2.5 years before the outbreak of the Civil War. Though the war was over by the time he was 6 years old, the conflict had an indelible impact on him, capturing his young imagination. He spent the rest of his life painting not just the Civil War, but scenes from various conflicts in America and abroad. He became famous for his ability to capture the raw emotion of battle, as well as for his attention to detail, says Joseph Eckhart, curator of So Bravely and So Well.
He is trying to actually evoke a sense of being there. It's almost like a movie director setting up a scene, and if the viewer is going to appreciate that scene and experience that event, every detail has to be right. And there is a kind of a cinematic quality about some of his work.
The exhibition, which contains over 80 objects, is the first show ever dedicated solely to Trigo's art. Coinciding with the show is the release of a fully illustrated biography written by Joseph Eckhart, and an online catalog resume, a complete listing and description of all the artist's works. Candace Clark, executive assistant to the director at the Michener Museum, says the digital catalog will be permanent.
And our hope is that it will not get out of date, that we will keep adding images to it and works to it as we become aware of those works. And we're also hoping that it's going to be kind of a focal point for scholars and collectors about Trigo, and that will encourage people to share information.
While the art on its own warrants an exhibition, equally as impressive as the work William Trigo produced is his life story and the physical hardship he overcame. At around age 2, he was afflicted by an illness, most likely polio. Joseph Eckhart says this severely affected Trigo's physical condition for his entire life.
What we know is that his hands were, as one reporter put it, twisted all out of shape. His right hand was the worst. It was bent back underneath of his wrist. The fingers were all curled up tight. It couldn't be moved. What movement he had was in the thumb and forefinger on the left hand. And so he would pick up the brush in those two fingers and then wedge it in among the frozen fingers on his right hand. And then he would use the left hand to push the right hand back and forth across the canvas, sometimes moving his entire body to make a brush stroke.
In addition to his difficulties with his hands, Trigo's mobility was limited, and he required assistance with many of his day-to-day activities. Yet his physical setbacks may have helped to spark his early creative impulses.
I suspect in the aftermath of the war, there were a lot of little boys who acted out their Civil War fantasies, acted out stories that their uncles or grandfathers had told them. Trigo, of course, couldn't do that. You know, he could hardly move. And so his way of processing the information was to put it on paper. Well, the other kids could go out and, you know, pretend they were leading a cavalry charge. He drew the cavalry charge.
Trigo's father, Jonathan, a successful artist himself who had studied under famed American portrait painter Thomas Sully, was quick to notice his son's raw talent and trained him as a painter. At age 20, William's first historical painting, The Charge of Custer at Winchester, won an award at the Michigan State Fair in Detroit, garnering critical and public praise. With the proceeds of the sale of that work, Trigo enrolled himself at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, a major turning point in his life.
At that point, he's leaving his father's training. His father's taught him everything he can possibly teach him. He goes on to the next step, onto the Pennsylvania Academy, which in those days was as good as it got. You know, to go study at the Pennsylvania Academy of Philadelphia was the ultimate experience for an aspiring artist.
During Trigo's time at the Academy, he was taught by Thomas Aikens. However, Aikens didn't pay him much attention.
Aikens was difficult to deal with. There's a story of Aikens sitting in front of his students' paintings and just staring at them for 15 minutes, and then he would get up and walk away and never say a word. Trigo himself said in a letter years later that he survived, quote, the neglect and sarcasm of Aikens. So I suspect that he didn't have a good experience with Aikens.
While still at the Academy in 1883, Trigo completed what is probably his most recognizable work, The March to Valley Forge, a 6-by-3-foot oil on canvas portraying General George Washington watching over a procession of troops in harsh winter conditions. The painting was also a source of controversy. Trigo entered it into a competition at the Academy for which the first prize was $3,000, about $50,000 today. However, despite the fact that the judges decided Trigo's work was the best, they ruled that none of the paintings submitted were good enough to win the prize.
So they said, yours is the best, you get the third prize, it's a silver medal, congratulations. And when they didn't reward him with what he thought he deserved, the first prize, he sued them. So he actually sued the Pennsylvania Academy. And it was a great scandal, enough that it made the New York Times. It went all the way to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the Academy won in the end.
Despite losing the lawsuit, the publicity from the scandal made the next few years Trigo's most commercially successful. In 1884, he moved back in with his family, who'd relocated to North Wales in suburban Philadelphia. Working alongside his father, Trigo was so productive that in 1887, he was able to finance a trip to Paris and enroll in a prestigious academy. Trigo successfully acclimated to French tastes and had paintings selected to be in the Paris Salon twice during his 3-year stay. His depictions of French soldiers bravely charging into battle earned plaudits from French critics, and even comparisons with their beloved Edouard de Taille.
And to pick out this young American studying in Paris and say, he's the rival of our great painter, that's the ultimate compliment.
Everything seemed like it was going right for William Trigo. He was a commercial and critical success in America as well as France, and he'd even found love. He met a young woman in Paris and proposed. She said yes, and they boarded a ship to America with plans to get married when they arrived.
But halfway across the Atlantic Ocean, she took a great liking to another young man on board the ship, and they were married, as it turned out. So Trigo's engagement, his romance, came to an end on the high seas, crossing over from France. He was so despondent that the captain ordered the crew to keep an eye on him. They were actually afraid he was going to climb over the rail and kill himself. And that it's almost like that's the dividing line of his life.
When Trigo arrived home in 1890, he had more problems than just his broken heart. Interest in military painting was waning, and his time spent overseas had cost him his commercial momentum in the U.S. He had moved back in with his father and stepmother in North Wales, but struggled to find work. He was denied a teaching position at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and in an effort to stay afloat financially, he began painting subjects outside of his area of expertise.
He begins to paint genre paintings, portraits, cats, the neighbor's cows, whatever they want painted. He begins to look for illustration jobs, which is something he didn't really want to do, but he knew that if he could get into that profession, it would be steady work.
He was never really able to tap into that market, though. After the death of his father in 1901 and stepmother in 1906, with financial problems growing and his physical setbacks impossible to manage on his own, Trigo was running out of options. Extended family in Massachusetts had arranged for Trigo to stay with them, but on the day he was scheduled to leave, he took his own life. William Trigo the man was quickly forgotten, but his legacy remained. Since his death, not a decade has passed without one of his works being reproduced in print. Now, with the retrospective of his career and the release of Joseph Eckhart's biography, Trigo can be remembered not just for his visually stunning paintings, but also for his character. He was a fiercely devoted artist who worked against adversity throughout his entire life. And despite how that life ended, Trigo's story stands as a testament to what can be accomplished with great talent and the endurance of the human spirit.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. So bravely and so well, the life and art of William T. Trigo is at the Michener Museum in Doylestown through October 2nd. Joseph Eckard's Trigo biography of the same name is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press this month.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
A great passion of the pianist Rudolf Buchbinder's has been the meticulous study of musical sources. Of particular interest are the piano works of Beethoven, whose scores he has collected in numerous editions. When he was in Philadelphia, I spoke with Rudolf Buchbinder and first asked him about how this dedication to the note on the page had evolved.
You know, it started slowly. These kind of things never come overnight. It started slowly when I got my first facsimile of a Beethoven sonata, and then I start to realize how much you discover from this facsimile. And so I started to collect all over the world, first editions and facsimile, and, you know, I can't believe it, but actually from all the pieces I play, and this is a lot, my repertoire is quite huge, you know, I have most from them, I have the first edition or a facsimile.
And what does that lend to your playing? Is there a sense of security that you know that this is what the composer intended?
First of all, a fingering by any strange pianist or any teacher has nothing to do with the original score of Beethoven, Mozart or Schubert or anyone. And you know, when I study a Beethoven sonata, I'm very lucky to have 18 different editions of the Beethoven sonatas. And so if I study one sonata, different editions are lying on the piano and I'm comparing one with the other. For instance, one edition I find it's wonderful edition, it's by Franz Liszt. Franz Liszt was a great admirer of Beethoven, and you know he was not a bad pianist, as we know. There's not one fingering of Franz Liszt in this score. Just we do it today. Why?
You asked the question, but there is a lot of emphasis today on the interpretation,
yeah,
that younger pianists are a lot of the time told that, yes, what's on the page is important, but they're putting their own personality into it is more important, and it's become more emphasized, I think, over recent years.
I think the artist, the student, the pianist, whoever plays the sonata, he has to find his own way to this piece, not the editor. And that's the point. You have to make a decision between edition. I mean, there are some old editions by Alfred Cortot or by Arthur Schnabel, where it's just one line of music on the page and the rest is texture, you know, explaining how it should be played and so on. Who cares about that?
Which, to an extent, is casting the musician in the role of almost a historian or as a historic actor, that they have to learn the context from the notes in the score.
Yes, they have to learn it by themselves. There's one exception, of course. There's a marvelous book of Karl Czerny about the interpretation of Beethoven's works. And, you know, you discover so many new things. You must imagine that Karl Czerny was able to play the whole music, what Beethoven wrote, even the string quartets, chamber music, by heart.
A lesson you've taken very much to heart, performing all five Beethoven in one day, and not merely for an audience, but have recorded it as well. Tell us about the process of taking in that amount of music to reproduce it over two concerts.
First of all, it was not my idea. It was from the director of the concert house. He said to me, Rudy, what do you think about the idea to play all five Beethoven concerts in one day? I said, wow, this is a hard job. But when you think some of my colleagues are practicing 6 hours a day, it is much worse. I never practiced in my life 6 hours a day. So I agreed, and we made one concert at 11 o'clock in the morning and the second at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this was recorded from the radio. And then the radio asked me, you know, Rudy, this is such a fantastic recording. Are we able to make a CD out of that? Then I said, of course, I have to control it. What I hate, because I never listen to my own recordings. Never.
Oh.
Never.
Not even for the editing process before it's released?
No. It's finished.
But do you always have a sense of when it's good?
I mean, yes.
How much of an effort was it for you to recall all of this music?
Well, I was counting a few days ago. How many piano concerti, if one asks me, can you play this tomorrow? How many piano concerti these are? These are 30.
My goodness.
So I can play 30 piano concerti immediately out of my 50 concerti, which I'm a repertoire. So 20 concerti are not in one day, then I need perhaps a few more days.
In view of these collections of scores that you have, in view of the very long relationship you've had now with the composer, who is Beethoven for you now as a man?
You know, the image, what people try to put into a person, all images are wrong. Beethoven was one of the most romantic and sensitive composers. When you play these 32 sonatas, you feel exactly in which sonata his mood, when he was in love, when he was in a bad mood. You know, when he dedicated many of his sonatas to his girls, you feel how much in love, how much deepness and soul is in this music.
Excerpt from Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, Rudolf Buchbinder conducting the Vienna Symphony Orchestra from the piano. The Historical Society of Pennsylvania has been accumulating papers, documents, and other historical records since 1824. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the Society's own story and how it's taking history into the future.
In a locked drawer of a secure vault in a large red brick building on a small corner in Philadelphia rests a diary. It once belonged to Tobias Lear, George Washington's personal secretary, who kept copious notes about, among other things, the details of the last moments of the president's life. Though its binding is worn and its browning pages thin, Historical Society of Pennsylvania president and CEO Kim Sayette can make out the handwritten scrawl.
I feel myself going. Thank you for your attentions, but I pray you to take no more trouble about me. Let me go off quietly. I cannot last long.
Heavily outlined in a box is written,
"He expired without a struggle or a sigh." So while we were fixed in silent grief, Mrs. Washington, who was sitting at the foot of the bed, asked with a firm and collected voice, "Is he gone?" I could not speak, but I held up my hand as a signal that he was no more.
Near the diary lives another journal. This, more of a business record.
Arrived, John Cannon, old name was London David, 21 years of age, black, tall, rather of a round built.
The journal belonged to 19th century African American William Still, a conductor in the Underground Railroad. This is his detailed record of the people who escaped to freedom through Philadelphia between 1852 and 1857. The vault also contains a first draft of the U.S. Constitution by James Wilson, who had become a justice on America's first Supreme Court, as well as two chalk drawings of William and Hannah Penn, rare glimpses of the images of these Quakers who publicly shied away from portraits. But these are just a fraction of what this building houses, says David Hilgard, director of research services.
In terms of research, these are the most valuable. So we have many, many rooms where we have restricted materials.
The stuff of ordinary lives that changed history has been landing on the Historical Society's doorstep since its founding in 1824. Director of Programs and Communications, Laurie Ciello, says over the next 60 years, as the collection grew, the Historical Society tried different locations, eventually purchasing in 1883 the former home of General Robert Patterson. The mansion, then 50 years old, had a garden, a greenhouse, and a history of entertaining.
Charles Dickens had been here, Ulysses S. Grant had been here, so it was a very well-known mansion. Everyone in the city knew about it. The Historical Society moved in, stored its collection here, opened as a library, and although the mansion was very beautiful, it wasn't big enough and it wasn't fireproof.
And so changes were made. Wings were added, including a large assembly hall to the west. And in the early 1900s, when these weren't enough, the Historical Society renovated the entire inside. The new building, much as it looks today, opened in 1910. With its soaring ceilings, decorative molding, original mantelpieces, and paintings on the walls, the ground floor has retained the traditional elegance of a mansion. Less obvious are certain features designed to protect against things like fire.
Here are one of the chairs from the original building, so if you can hear. It's not wood. It's made of metal.
Oh, my goodness. They look like wood chairs.
Yeah, the bookcases in the assembly hall, they are all made of metal. What looks like wooden crown molding, none of it is wood. Everything is painted metal.
And in a feature right out of a James Bond movie, sliding doors.
We have these that separate the different rooms in the Historical Society and the vaults. And if the temperature gets up to a certain level, a metal plug melts at the top of the door and it drops and these doors will automatically close. It was very state of the art at the time.
While the Historical Society initially collected objects as well, including a music stand owned by Benjamin Franklin and the wampum belt believed to have been given to William Penn by a Lenape tribe, in the early 1990s, the Society decided to focus on its mission as a research library and gave the objects to the Atwater Kent Museum. In 2002, the Society merged with the Balch Institute, which added to its collection of immigrant history about 4 million more items. Today, the collection includes over 21 million physical items from both famous and ordinary people, some that belong to the Historical Society, some held in trust for other organizations.
So, for example, we have a huge amount of sheet music through the ages. We have the photo morgue, as they call it, of the Philadelphia Record, one of the major newspapers in Philadelphia. We have recipes that people have kept, menu cards I've seen, family snapshots, letters. It really does run the gamut.
Because the Historical Society is a research library and not a museum, most people who walk through the door are scholars, genealogists, or family historians. But today, the Society is also reaching out to a larger public. Matt Shoemaker is project director for the Digital Center for Americana, which is currently digitizing parts of its 51 Civil War collections.
One of the main things we're trying to do is make our collections more accessible online. We're going to have digital signposts, which are select images that have been digitized in certain collections to give researchers a better idea of the kinds of things they'll find in a collection if they come to use it.
Another online project is Philaplace, an interactive website that maps and annotates neighborhoods of Philadelphia. The project has started with the riverfront neighborhoods historically known as Southwark and Greater Northern Liberties. Project coordinator Melissa Mandel says as populations changed, many buildings were adapted for reuse.
They may have started out as a very small Jewish synagogue in the 19th century, then it turned into a German Catholic church, and then as that population maybe scattered or moved to another neighborhood, it's now an African-American Baptist or Protestant church. That's really common. And, of course, with Northern Liberties, seeing the transformation of industrial spaces into housing or artist lofts or studios, the traces of the history are still in the landscape.
Visitors to the website can click on links to essays by historians or read stories and watch videos about ordinary people.
Well, it used to be a very famous location. It was a hangout corner, and they had two delicatessens there.
People looking for history in Philadelphia may start with the Liberty Bell and the blocks around Independence Hall. But as the Historical Society of Pennsylvania is highlighting, history is all around us, in neighborhood streets, homes, places of business, and houses of worship. Evidence of generations past that have shaped the present and will continue to inform the future.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The second book from two Philadelphia Museum of Art educators is out now on Temple University Press. Art Museum Opposites by Katie Friedland, the museum's manager of family and children's programs, and Marla Shoemaker, the senior curator of education, follows the success of 2008's A is for Art Museum. The aim of Art Museum Opposites is to help 4 to 8-year-old children learn the difference between such concepts as little and lots, big and small, and old and new, using paintings, sculptures, and other objects from the museum's collections. I spoke with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
So the first book was an easy alphabet-based project. How did either or both of you decide that this one would take a turn to the left or the right and be about opposites? Marla?
We both very much wanted to do a book that was a little more complex and ask of people to look at two objects together. And that comes from a lot of different things. Kids, one of the very first skills kids learn is compare and contrast. It's how they learn their colors. They learn this is red because it doesn't look like this one and this one is blue. So this, it's a very, very early skill that you use your whole life in very subtle ways, but that starts very early. And secondly, because I'm trained in art history is always taught with two slides on the screen at one time. And there's a reason for that, because it's easier to talk about it. Somehow it's easier to say, well, see how these lines are thinner than these lines over here, because thin is a relative term.
Right.
So thin could mean Katie, who's nice and slender, or could mean a tiny little line, you know. So looking at two things together is what we do a lot here at the museum.
So you're getting to these kids young in the hope of turning them into art historians. I know what you're doing.
It can be a really rich conversation, and it can go a lot of places. And it brings, in our own teaching of children here, which both Katie and I do in the galleries, kids are just really good at it. They're really good at comparing and contrasting, and the longer you look, the more things you notice. So we knew we wanted to work with two images on a spread.
Let me turn to you, Katie. So you then began walking through the galleries, as you do here regularly in the course of your job, and immediately seeing things as opposites, or how did you both go about deciding what opposites would be in the book?
It was a really fun, Marla and I called it our card game that we were playing in our office. We also got to sort of almost experiment as curators, because we work in education, but to pull up two works of art that might be on opposite sides of the building, but we would print them out and look at them in our office and say, oh my God, look how amazing they look together. Look how they illustrate something together. It was exciting. So there was definitely a lot of walking. I mean, it's a huge collection and not everything is on view. So it was a lot of searches, you know, big web searches on our computers. That it was just really fun.
How many of the objects that are in the book can be seen by young visitors to the museum?
I would say about half, probably. I would say about half of the images are available to be seen. But the great thing about the museum, and one of the wonderful things why people should come back so often, is that the objects in the galleries are often changing. So just because an image is on view doesn't mean that it will be on view forever, and something else might rotate onto view. So some of the objects in the empty and full, the big pot of mussels was something that was on view a few years ago that I remember teaching with and I remember kids loving, but it's not on view now.
So, Marla, then when you were looking at the objects, how complex or simple did they need to be for the audience they were intended for?
We really believe that kids are capable of looking at complex images, and we spend the bulk of the money on the book in creating beautiful, beautiful, super high-quality photographs of images. We're really invested in that. So these works of art look great in the book. Of course, they look even greater when you see them in person, but they're quite spectacular.
In the overall philosophy of art education at the museum, is it about creating art aficionados who will become future visitors? And if so, how do these books feed into that, do you think?
Well, I do think not in a, you know, in a holistic approach, we are definitely trying to, you know, our goal is to promote the museum and to help families not necessarily come to our museum, but to become more visually literate and to have a larger interest in works of art as a whole, because we really think that works of art are important and can enrich your life. So I hope that people come more often. We do know that through studies that if you come with your family to a museum as a child, you're more likely to come back as an adult. So we know that that's true, and I hope that people visit. But more, I think Marla and I both just wanted to share these works of art that we think are so beautiful and that we really enjoy looking at, and wanted children to be able to enjoy them too.
Philadelphia Museum of Art educators Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, authors of Art Museum Opposites, out now on the Temple University Press imprint. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.